This is HPR episode 2226 entitled, Fosdem 2017 AW Building, and is part of the series, Interviews. It is hosted by Ken Fallon, and is about 69 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Ken interviews the projects in the AW Building.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi, I'm at the Coreboot stand and I'm talking to
Julian Lobstein.
Hi, what is Coreboot?
Coreboot is an open source firmware replacement. So remember on your hardware, on your mainboard, on your computer, you have a BIOS chip that's initializing your hardware and everything, every component in your PC. So Coreboot is essentially an open source replacement for that. That makes it really, really fast, and it's really, really modern written because most of the code in BIOS systems, and commonly used BIOS systems, is like 50 years old or even older. So technology is really not that up to date. And you have a lot of flexibility when using Coreboot. You can load different so-called payloads. So after initializing the hardware, you are able to load like an open source BIOS system where you can tweak your system or something like that. You're also able to load a bootloader like RUP2. And the craziest thing I ever seen is that a friend of mine loaded a Linux kernel, an actual Linux kernel, onto its BIOS, and that worked really, really well, and was really, really fast as well.
That would be a very small BIOS, or a very small kernel.
Yeah, it would be a very small kernel. What's the minimum requirement kernel, I guess, but it worked really well, and the startup time was like half a second. That's what really amazing. It was just an experiment and just an expression of what Coreboot can do for you, I guess.
Well, why would I even want to bother with that? Surely my BIOS is okay. It's been good for 50 years. It's going to be good for another 50 years.
Yeah, you're right. It's just been good. It's done well for 50 years, but the problem is that it's really, really slow most of the time. Okay, you could say it's only at boot time, but the boot process is sometimes a thing when it comes to you're in a hurry and you want to start up your PC very quickly, then you might get in trouble with loading the BIOS. At home, my proprietary BIOS takes 5 seconds to load, and that's like you say, oh, 5 seconds, but with Coreboot it was like 20 milliseconds or so. So it's really, really fast, and also. Since it's not proprietary, you have the full control over what you're using, and the FBI or the CIA or the NSA, if I'm being a little bit paranoid, can tap into your BIOS and can install a keylogger on your BIOS, because that's possible. We've seen that.
Okay. So from a security point of view, it's useful. From a speed point of view, are there any people that we might know using it in mainstream systems?
There are huge companies that are actually using it, like Google, for example. You know, the Google Chromebooks, they are all shipping with Coreboot. Since when they developed the idea of having notebooks that are really, really fast and have a really, really small memory overhead, they thought about implementing their own BIOS, but at the time Coreboot was so great that they said, okay, I'll just let 10 people work on Coreboot on the open source project and contribute to it, and we just use that because it's much better than anything we could build.
So how what sort of devices are available to put a new BIOS on, and do I not run the risk of bricking my device if I start putting a new BIOS on it?
Yeah, the risk of bricking is also always something that is a concern of people when it comes to Coreboot. Let's start with your first questions. The most machines corporates used on is laptops, hackers' laptops, mostly ThinkPads. We have a huge variety of ThinkPads, huge model variety of ThinkPads that are compatible with Coreboot. Your second question about bricking your device. Installing Coreboot is not that easy. You have to open up, at least for the first install, you have to open up your PC and have to find your BIOS chip, and you have to make a backup of your BIOS. And you have to make this backup a few times, so you can be sure that it's the exact backup. And after that, you extract binary blobs from the backup, build your Coreboot image, and reflash it. So at this point, when your device doesn't boot up, you can just flash the backup onto your BIOS chip, and you're good.
You make it sound so easy. I suspect there are people shouting down the microphone, "You bricked my laptop, dude!"
Yeah, probably, but it's not an easy process. And if you're not familiar and you've not done it 1,000 times, I flash notebooks 1,000 times. So I'm very familiar with what problems could occur, and I'm really I'm aware of that. You have to make the backup, and you have to be sure that it's the real backup. Because I saw so many people crying about their BIOS and saying, "What? How can I fix this? This is never going to be fixed." And yeah, this is a real concern. But if you have people on your side that are helping you and they know how to do it, like me or like Philip here, usually don't get in such trouble. But
so the advice to people is, if you can, find a Coreboot team that are around, go and get them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you could do it yourself. We always advise people to at least try it. But if you're not completely sure you can do it, just find a local hackerspace or go to the Chaos Communication Congress, where every year there's a huge Coreboot stand where we help you. We are happy to help you with flashing your Coreboot image.
Super. Anything else that we missed or that you want to tell us about?
I guess that sums it all up.
And more information will be on the website, coreboot.org. And thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm talking to the Grub team. You are?
I'm Vladimir Serbinenko, one of the Grub maintainers.
Daniel Kipper, also Grub maintainer. New one, Grub maintainer.
Okay, so what is Grub?
Grub is a bootloader which is used in several Linux distributions and also on some other operating system, including Solaris. And we basically try to coordinate different boot efforts so we have one unified solution.
So you're the thing that turns the computer, when the computer turns on, it goes to you guys?
Not directly. It's start usually with BIOS or EFI or Coreboot, and only from them we get the control. But the Grub is usually the first thing which is controlled by the distribution in most cases.
Okay. And why do I need to use Grub? Why can't I just go straight into Linux?
On BIOS systems, the startup is in ugly 16-bit mode, and it has all kinds of ugly limitations. It's easier to write a specialized bootloader, which would basically place first in the decent mode, and then start the kernel. With EFI, this is less of an issue. You can have setups where you go straight to the kernel. But we provide additional features, like, for example, we provide the interface to choose the kernel. We provide also the features like one-time boot. When you have a new kernel and you're on remote server, you can tell the Grub, "Try this kernel. If it works, then good. If it doesn't work, then after reboot, go to the old kernel."
Yeah. I've I have the feeling that I'm not even beginning to scratch the surface of what Grub can do. I've seen some people load BSD and load kernels from here and there and all the rest. Is there a good place that I can go to learn about all the things Grub can do?
One place that I would recommend is probably our official manual. It's not up to the shape where everything is documented, but it's actually now much better than people think about it. It's because there was a time when it was almost empty. Yeah. Now it's slightly better, and I have actually assembled a couple of common questions, for example, common question how you can coordinate several operating systems from one single grub. It's what was asked a lot, and now it's in manual. This way, I can just paste the link to the manual whenever this question is asked.
Fantastic. Previously, we had Lilo, and then we had Grub, and one of the main advantages of Grub was that you didn't need to run anything after you installed a new kernel. Yeah. Now, with Grub 2, we're back to the days where if you forget to regenerate the Grub config, you can get into your trouble. Why is that? You need to reconfigure, if you make changes to your hard disks or whatever, you need to go and reconfigure Grub. It doesn't automatically detect anymore in the way it used to. Has that changed?
That hasn't changed. It's actually uses exact Grub, old Grub and new Grub uses exactly the same algorithm for this. Actually, new Grub is changed in the way that it's more robust, because the old Grub used just a disk name, which can change, but now we use UID to find in partitions. Probably what you say is that you need, the only thing that you need to rerun is basically just adding your kernel to the list of the bootable kernels, the new kernels to the list of the bootable kernels.
So there should be no problem. If we forget to do that, it'll boot the old kernel and I'm still okay.
Yeah. You needed to rerun install only after major changes, like for example, if you have reformatted your partition.
Okay.
Or if you heavily changed your partition scheme, like swap partitions around. Actually robust that you don't need to rerun it if you just swap the drives around.
Yeah.
But only if you modified what's on the disks.
Okay.
And in my major way, like reformat or repartitioning and so on.
But on a project like Grub, it's been around so long, surely it must be finished. You must be finished by now. When are you going to stop?
No, it's not possible. We are going to add many, many new features. Currently, Vladimir 2 days ago released RC1, and it contains many new features. It contains support for ARM 64 platform, ARM. What else?
Sandbar virtualization. One of the problems which many people had is that if you have Sandbar virtualized domain, the kernel needs to be on privileged domain, and which is a security hole. And there have been exploits which allowed you to get out of virtualized system. And the solution that we provide is basically just put Grub outside. And then Grub will basically run inside the machine and load whatever kernel you need.
Okay. Also, we add that multi-boot protocol extension for UEFI. So currently, images which supports multi-boot protocol are able to use boot services. In the future, we also are going to add some security features. For example, support for TPM. They were posted by Matthew Garrett, but we are not able to get it right now because we are just before release, but it is planned to get into next release. We are also going to have a support for SIM verification, UEFI secure boot verification. So there is a lot of things to do, a lot of stuff to do.
So we'll actually host a lightning talk today, where we'll basically give news of what has been happening in the project. Where we'll also speak about our new candidate logo. Here you are.
You need one.
If you want more information about the logo, here you have the person who actually did it.
Maria is working on the logo. She is our main designer of it.
Excellent. And so new stuff coming up this year. You have plenty to do.
Yeah.
And the Lightning talks will be available on the FOSDEM website. So by the time you hear this, they should probably be up. Yeah. Have we missed anything that's coming up?
I don't think so.
License is Grub.
We can talk, let's say, a whole day about
I fear that that's, you might be talking over my head.
Yeah, we can talk a whole day about future plans and future possible plans, but it's probably not the best place. If you want to participate in the discussion, we have developer mainly list where we have all kinds of topics and all kinds of directions. And I cannot make specific promises about what exactly will happen, because, well, if I could predict what exactly will happen 1 year from now, I think I would make a lot of money.
Yes, exactly. What sort of license is Grub Release under?
Version 3 or later.
Yeah. Okay. In general, it is Grub 2 is developed on FSF umbrella. But there are a lot of companies also support Grub 2 development. For example, I work for Oracle. Another guy who joined maintenance team also work for Oracle. So there are also many huge companies which are support Grub 2 development.
Okay, guys, thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Okay, thank you.
I'm at the Olimex booth, and I'm talking to
Svetlana Zonov. I'm Olimex owner.
What is Olimex?
Olimex is a small company in Bulgaria. We are doing electronic design, PCB assembly, development tools. Recently, we made this do-it-yourself modular open source laptop.
You made a laptop that's open source?
Yes, exactly. The laptop comes in kit form. It has components which you can assemble by your own hands and later run Linux on it.
But it looks very much like something like a Acer Aspire 1 or one of those.
Exactly. But here we have every design files and CAD files open. They are made with free software with KiCad, so everybody can download KiCad, download our source files, and if he doesn't like something, he can modify and make it up to his test.
So you could you sell these kits, obviously.
Right now, the kits are ready as hardware. We work it almost a year, maybe more than a year on it. But the software is still very immature. Okay. So we need about a couple of months to polish the software so it becomes usable.
So when somebody gets a kit, presuming that they don't make them themselves, what's inside the kit?
Inside the kit, you get the plastic parts, speakers, Wi-Fi antennas, LCDs, the main boards and other boards. And you have assembly instructions, which are very simple. For 1 hour, you can build your own laptop and you can start developing. The good thing is that everything is available. Everything is free. You have freedom to change. Even the keyboard, for instance, we use a small Arduino board, which makes USB hit keyboard. So if you don't like the keyboard layout or something like this, you can have a sources here, recompile, upload new firmware, you get a new keyboard firmware and new keyboard behavior.
Fantastic. But surely I'm going to need to know how to solder and how to cut.
No, it doesn't need any soldering. Everything is pre-soldered, tested, assembled. You just have to put all everything together.
So why don't you just sell completely made laptops? Why would I put it together myself?
Because it will have no fun. You can buy assembled laptop everywhere, but this laptop you will build with your own hands. You will know every bit of it. If something breaks, every part is available as spare. So if you broke a key, you don't have to throw the whole laptop. Just get a spare key and replace it. If the battery die after 3 years or something, you just disconnect the battery, put new battery, and your laptop is again like new.
So I can make modifications to your drawings.
Absolutely. We uploaded everything on GitHub, and we start getting emails from people that like said, oh, but this is ARM architecture. I want to make my own with MIPS, or I want to make my own with PowerPC. Or so we give a template, we give a base which people can tweak up to their own needs. If they don't like something, they can change it, because everything is open and they have access to it.
What sort of processor, what sort of motherboard do you get?
We start with ARM processor. It's a 64-bit quad-core ARM processor, and we are going to move to different platform later. The idea here is to make a laptop which is lightweight. Its weight is less than 1 kilogram. The battery has to last one day, so you can travel with it. You can do some small hacking, like programming Arduinos, do other coding or something like this. This is not a developer machine. This machine will never do Linux kernel or fancy graphic stuff. This is just something like portable laboratory. Our next step is to add small FPGA board, which will transform this laptop also to oscilloscope and logic analyzer. So basically, you can get it with you, go somewhere, sniff some protocols on hardware level, analyze them, do things like this.
And if I got the laptop now, is that something that I can add later?
Yes. As you see here, we have plenty of space to put another boards inside. So if you want to add some functionality which is not available now, no problem. It's up to you. Everything is given you in your hand. This is like a tool. What you will shape, what you will do, depends of you.
Why did you make it open source? What's stopping somebody from sending all the designs over to China and producing thousands and millions of these devices? You don't see a cent.
Well, we do this for fun. We spent over a year to develop this laptop, and it was fun while we developed it, and we learned a lot of stuff while we developed it. I don't care if somebody takes the design and start to produce in China. Even now, there are millions of different laptops, but nobody gives you this freedom, which we are doing. If you go to China, nobody will release you the schematics, the CAD files, the things. So basically, if you buy market laptop, you cannot do a lot of stuff to modify it. Here you have absolutely freedom to do whatever you want. Some people ask, okay, but the LCD is not with good resolution. I say, no problem, go to eBay, find EDP display with bigger resolution, spend another 200 euro just for the LCD, put it in the laptop, it will work, because you have the specs, you have the schematic, you have everything, and you can do this on this laptop because everything is open.
Absolutely awesome. How much is it?
The base kit is 225 euro. It's about $240, something like this. Yeah. But this is the beginning. As I said, we are going to release additional modules with FPGAs, where when you can synthesize different CPUs like RISC-V or something, if you want to develop with new cores and things.
Fantastic. So that's all coming up this year. Anything else we missed?
I don't know.
The links to your website, and then go now and take some photographs, will be in the show notes for this episode. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Automotive Grade Linux booth, and I'm talking to
Jan-Simon Müller.
So, can you tell me what Automotive Grade Linux is?
Automotive Grade Linux is a Linux distribution for the automotive industry, and it's made for car makers, which will pick it up and then put it in the cars in the end.
Okay, so why would somebody want to do that?
Because the car industry needs to speed up their development, and Linux is their choice here. And Automotive Grade Linux is here to provide a common ground and a common platform.
And what do I get with Automotive Grade Linux? What are the features? What are the benefits? Why not just use Debian?
So what are the features? Automotive Grade Linux is a distribution. We use open source tools like the Yocto project underneath, and it's tailored towards automotive. So we have automotive software components in our distribution, and we also added things like an own home screen, an application framework for enhanced security. So there is a few more things to keep in mind than on a regular desktop.
Okay. And do you support things like separation of the cables, or do you support engine monitoring in automotive networking? Mm.
Okay. So what's supported right now is that we can actually access the CAN bus. So we have a demo which uses, by the way, the first open source CAN and MOST drivers, which enter the Linux kernel in 4.x. Yeah. It's in the staging directory, so it's open source. And the access to the automotive interfaces is being done, of course. Things like full access to the CAN bus is nothing a driver should have.
Yes.
But we will, in the next couple of months, we will add support for OBD2 dongles, so you can get some data from out of your car.
Who puts the distribution on, and who maintains it? Who updates it if there are security issues?
That's the car makers and their suppliers' business.
Okay, and do they do that over the air, or do you need to go into this?
Yes, that will be done over the air. We even have a demo here at the stand showing over the air updates. So that's been taken care of. Also, the interaction with the security features, because deploying just the update is not enough. You have also to work together with the enhanced security. We are using things like SMAC to do that.
Okay. I don't have a car. So if I bought a car, could I just install it myself, or can I roll my own distro?
No. Now, to be fair, car makers have to certify their cars for safety, and they wouldn't get the permission to sell that thing, right?
Yeah.
No, to be fair.
Okay, so why are we here? Why bother with FOSDEM at all then?
So, as an open source project, we provide developers a way to develop the base distro with us, but also to develop applications on top of AGL. So the application framework gives you the opportunity to write your own application that can then be deployed in a car.
And can the consumer do that themselves, or is that something that the car manufacturers would allow from an app store or something?
App store style, yes.
So how are those applications written? What framework? How would I go about it?
Yeah, we are not bound to one single framework. So here for the demo, we used Qt5 QML,
yeah,
which, because it's very nice and easy. But there is also work on other frameworks.
Well, what sort of applications have you got in mind? What's the best, coolest thing you've seen so far?
Well, if I knew the coolest thing, I would write it right now.
Yeah.
Right? But navigation, point of interest, location-based services.
Opening and closing your house door when you come home?
Possibly, yeah.
Not only have they stolen your car, they've stolen your house.
Yeah, well, as you approach your house, you do whatever, right?
And music players, media players, all that sort of thing.
Of course. We have that already in the demo, also radio. As you can see, we also have support the Raspberry Pi. So it's very easy to try out automotive-grade Linux, get a Raspberry Pi, connect the monitor, burn our SD card image, and the radio works as soon as you plug in an SDR receiver.
Yeah.
And as I said, in the next month we plan to add OBD2, so
you get engine statistics.
We get the statistics, yes.
But you don't physically connect to the bus of the car.
No.
Okay. Physically,
well, as ordinary developers. the car makers will pick that up, obviously, yes.
Yeah. And will they, do they tend to keep those two separate, or I would hope the answer would be yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So we're not talking self-driving car here on at this point.
Well, an eye is on that, yeah. But surely not. We are targeting more the in-vehicle infotainment, the dashboard,
yeah.
the instrument cluster, but not the thing which really does the self-driving. Well, maybe just the base distro. Yeah, but
do you not have like requirements to turn off movies and stuff in the front dash or?
Yeah, that's a requirement. How that will be implemented, that's up to the car maker then.
But you could have a control panel where the driver has a control panel and you have LCD screens for the kids in the back and that's right.
Back, exactly. Multi-screen support is one of our requirements. Yes, yeah. So you can basically send the video stream to the back seat and so on.
Yeah.
So yes, sure.
So point out some of the boards here and as we're going, I'll take some photos. Actually, you hold that?
Yes.
That being the microphone?
Yeah, what boards do we have here? Well, besides developer boards, Raspberry Pi, the Intel Mino board, the Intel Joule over here, we have, of course, automotive target platforms. One of them is the Renesas Porta board, and the other one is the successor of the Porta, that's the Gen 3. Here you see the UI.
Okay, so this UI is a massive big tablet, huge tablet in actual fact. Define huge, how big is that in inches? 13 inch, okay. So tell me about this, what am I seeing there?
You're seeing here the, we call that home screen, and from there you can access the different applications.
So I've got climate control, navigation, phone, radio, multimedia mixer, nice big buttons, and at the top I just see tabs, so obviously it's going to be tabs.
Bar, yes, yeah. Yes. That's our version that we demonstrated at the last CES, so that's this year's demonstrator.
Yeah, and this is connected up to which board? This board here?
Yes.
And what's that board?
That's the Renesas Porta board.
Yep.
That's an automotive platform as
fairly bog standard. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And that's would be mounted inside the car, inside the dash somewhere?
Probably. A variant of this, yes.
And all we have coming out is regular USB and HDMI.
It's very similar to a regular development board or PC. That thing has PCI Express, a couple of specific connectors, things like a direct CAN connector and so on. You will not find that on standard boards.
Yeah. So you could hack this to get into the CAN.
If you...
Or not.
Yeah, well. But you, sure, you don't want to brick your own car, right?
No, not so much.
So what else? Why would I have a Raspberry Pi when I've got a car? Mm-hmm. What are you using the Raspberry Pi for? What's the purpose?
Oh, it's a very nice development platform, and you can get the full UI up also there.
Yeah.
And now, let's say if I want to play with automotive grade Linux. Oh, wait a second. I can bring that one up.
I'll take a photo of the back there, just one sec.
Oh, that's the wrong one.
So what I'm looking at is like a... just an LCD that's on the stand with a Raspberry Pi snugly fitted into the back, which is kind of nice. And you've got a row of buttons on the...
That's Lego.
Lego? Oh, right. Where did you get these? Are they custom-made, the cases?
Smart Pi Touch.
So I'm never going to... Can you put that into the light? And I'll see if I can... Smart Pi Touch.
That was a Kickstarter.
Yeah, it looks nice. Nice little board.
And, well, let's say in a few months when the OBD2 has been added, you can, for example, take the Raspberry Pi with a screen and put it in the car, and we will get some live values on the dashboard. Yeah, for example,
we're looking at a picture of a car with the front left tire, the right tire, that sort of stuff.
Of course, not while driving.
No.
Yeah. Applications that we have, for example, the climate controls over here, they work completely. So they are really made to access the canvas. So one of the companies did a full demo, so the actuators move, the fan moves, and all driven from this interface. So that's all there with open drivers. Navigation works. It's an open source navigation application, which was done by Hitachi. It's open source, it's on GitHub. Beside that, radio, media player, what you would expect.
Yeah, it looks very much like, you know, a future car should look like if you were looking at it in the movie.
Yeah.
Very slick interface.
And with the Raspberry Pi, a screen.
You can demo your apps.
You can demo your apps. You can develop your apps. And
then where do I do it? So I'm a budding developer and I've developed a killer app for the, hopefully not literally, killer app for a car. Where do I submit my applications then?
Yeah, that's still in the works. Once the car makers pick the system up, the app stores will come.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Anything else that's coming up next year that we need to know about?
Yeah, so next year we will enhance the platform. We already have an SDK, so if you want to get a head start, try our images, try our SDK. For the next years, we will work on the signaling, so more on the canvas, and APIs for the applications to access values from the canvas in a controlled manner and so on. So that's being done right now.
Fantastic. Great stuff. Well, good luck here with the show and I hope it turns out to be a success.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, I'm at the Amateur Radio stand and we're talking to
Christoph Bonner.
So what is Amateur Radio?
Amateur radio is, let's start this way, perhaps a better way to explain it. There are three hobbies which deal with radio.
Yep.
One of them is broadcasts, free radio, which deals with journalism and music. That's not it.
Okay.
The second one is you use your radio for, you go hiking, you have a walkie-talkie, that's using your radio, that's not it. So then you have citizen band and amateur radio. The difference is that citizens about talk and amateur radio is a technical scientific hobby, which is a very different way of actually looking at it. It's about the radio communication, the radio technology. It's about how to, well, communicate, but actually about the technical aspect. Of course, you can still use it to talk, of course. You could use it to talk to people, but actually it's more on the technical side, on the scientific side, on how radio communication works, how things work. And that's a very different point of view from looking at it.
Okay, how do you start? You buy a 25 euro radio and you just start talking left, right, and center, I guess.
Well, most people get started because they see somebody else doing it. You're in a hackerspace and they have another ham, because a ham is also another word for an amateur radio. Radio amateur, sorry. And you start thinking. So if you want to do and start in, actually communicating, you get yourself a 20 euro walkie-talkie, that's it. A lot of the people actually start by one of those RTL SDR sticks.
Yeah.
And they stick in a computer and all of a sudden they see all kind of weird things coming off the computer, and that's radio. Radio communication, by the fact it's so visual, by an RTL stick, is they see what actually is radio is. It's not something you hear or some signals that are somewhere in the air. But actually it's something you can look at and you can see what it behaves, what it is, what it is.
So what's an RTL? What does RTL mean?
RTL is short for Realtek. I think it's the company who made the sticks. So actually it's a DVB-T stick, so it's for the digital television. But they found out that you can actually reconfigure the stick as being an SDR receiver. So if you just stick it in your computer, put an antenna on the other side, otherwise you won't have much to listen to. And then you actually have the software, you can see visually on your computer all the radio signals that are around you. You could listen to the broadcast, your television signal. It could be another amateur radio repeater. It could be a paging server, paging repeater, which is somewhere in your neighborhood. And all of a sudden you see all those things around you.
Do I not need some software in order to do that?
Yeah, but you need, but there's open source. Are SDR software that's available, so that's not a problem. You need software for that.
Can you give me an example of one?
The Linux example. QSD, well, if you just Google for SDR software LTL, you're going to find it anyway, so that's not a problem.
There are some websites that you, even without that, you can go to and see the waterfall as well.
Yeah, okay, that's the web SDR. That actually are, well, PCs with an SDR receiver in it, with usually a better antenna than just a little stick you have in a computer. And you can see the same thing. You can see everything that goes around you, which is quite interesting for us as amateur radios. Could be that we are in an environment, let's say we live in a city with a lot of radio noise. So it could be that our reception at home is actually worse than being in an RTL receiver, as a web SDR receiver somewhere, because they are placed in a location where there's not much less noise. So it could be that we send out we transmit and we talk to somebody else on the other side of the world, and we transmit from at home, but we listen actually using a receiver which is located a bit further down, but hopefully in a place with less radio noise than in the crowded city where you live.
But you do need a license in order to, you can receive without any problem, but you do need a license in order to send any communication out.
Yeah, that's correct. So amateur radio requires to have a license, and license is linked to an exam. You need to do a technical exam to get a license. There are two main reasons for that. First is, do not blow up yourself. My license, my normal license allows me to transmit 1,500 watts of power into the antenna. To do that, I actually need to put 3 or 4 kilowatts of power into my transceiver. And considering the fact that you actually could build this thing yourself, you better make sure what you're doing. So you need to have a license, because you have to show you a little bit of technical knowledge that you know what you're dealing with. The other thing is that radio waves do not stop at the walls of your house. So it could be that you're interfering with your neighbors. Or in my case, I live in Ostend on the Belgian coast. We have an airport over there. And there are things called automatic landing systems, which actually use radio, my apologies. So it could be that you make your transmitter and it transmit on the frequency you want to transmit, but it also transmit on harmonics. And could be that one of the harmonics is used by a plane which actually is trying to do an automatic landing. So better make sure what you're doing. So that's why they have the exam.
Okay, but when you're talking about making your own receiver, it's easier to get into the hobby than that. You can do a novice license and you can buy a cheap device that ain't going to kill anybody. Because I think we're scaring people off there.
Okay.
To get like in a novice in, what do we need to do?
Okay, that's correct, of course. I mean, you just try to explain why you need a license. That was not to scare.
You're going to kill people. Think of the children.
Okay, that's true. Okay, for instance, in Belgium, the novice license does not allow you to make your own transmitters. So you could buy commercial equipment. You can buy a 20 or 30 euro handy talkie or a 100 euro digital voice radio. So that's not. And actually, the license, which the basic license, is more an operator license than actually, because you're not supposed to build your own. You are allowed to build your own antennas. You're allowed to build your own equipment, which actually sits behind your transceiver. So if you want to do things like keyboard to keyboard digital communication over shortwave, which is one of the modes we do, then you're allowed to build that yourself. So there is a lot of still technical hobby and technical things around it. And also building stuff yourself, but not builds that, not stuff that transmits.
Okay.
So that's for the basic license.
Yeah, and even an advanced license is, once you get into it, it starts becoming easier and...
Well, you have the knowledge, and for instance, in the intermediate license in the UK, you need to solder something. You have to show that you actually can able to solder. It's through hole soldering, so it's still not still feasible. That's not the problem. But I mean, you just have to show that you know what you're doing. And by starting at an office, and you build your, and you go up to the other license, actually it goes by itself. But one thing that the interesting thing about amateur radio is actually it's more about radio. It's more than just radio. In our club where we are, we actually work a lot with a couple of guys who are on the astronomy club, stargazers. And I was trying to explain to them, we have something called Whisper, which is a digital mode which is able to decode signals which are smaller than the noise. So we have your noise and your signal exactly is less than that. And there's a special software which does that. I was talking to the guy in the astronomy club, explaining that, and he said, you know, we do exactly the same thing. if you want to take a picture of something very weak, like deep sky, say whatever, the noise of your antenna, the CCD camera and your antenna, is more than your picture of the noise of the image coming in. So what they do something called a photo stacking. They don't take one image, they take 10, 20, 100, and for every pixel, they take the average. What actually happens, because noise is sometimes positive and sometimes negative, your average disappears. And you actually, by magic, you kind of have an image pops up out of nowhere, out of noise. And then you see that the techniques we use in radar and radio are the same that they use. And then you start seeing that it's not that you sit in your own corner just doing radio, we actually are working with technology. And that's interesting because technology is everywhere and you see a lot of the same principles coming in our hobby and other hobbies, and then you start seeing connections. And that's where it actually becomes really, really interesting. It is about radio. Radio has something magical. So it's always been. My first contact has been with somebody in Norway. You have to imagine I'm at home. I sit behind my radio. I have a cable going up to my attic. I have a small piece of wire. And I talk in my radio, the electricity of that radio goes into that wire, disappears somewhere. And all of a sudden, 2,000 kilometers away, some guy 300 kilometers north of the polar circle replies to me. That's
awesome.
Yeah, that's magic.
Yeah, that's
cool. So radio by itself does have something magical. It's kind of a way that you have electricity going over the air, which you don't see, and all of a sudden you can use it to talk to somebody or communicate or whatever. But it also has a practical application, and it is also a very fun thing to do.
It's a lot of people get, the thing I've been interested in amateur radio for a while, the thing I've noticed is the motivation of people coming in. It's such an overarching hobby. It's like Linux free and open source software. Everybody's got their own aspect. Some people come into it because they're into mountain rescue. Some people come into it because they're into astronomy. And some people come into it because they're just into deep electronics. So this is one of the most frustrating things about trying to nail down an amateur radio enthusiast. Okay, how do you get somebody into amateur radio? Well, now, that depends on what you're interested in.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. Now, what we do is, when we have people coming in, we try to get the name and the contacts. First of all, amateur radio is usually done in local clubs. And a club lives on its members. So we have clubs where we have guys who do contesting and field days. Field days is some field day is where you try to set up a station which is autonomous, which works by itself, is used for emergency communication because radio does only needs a transmitter and a wire. So emergency situations where there's no internet, has been an earthquake like in Italy a couple of weeks ago. That's one of the aspects. So clubs, people who are interested in that. But if you come in and say I'm interested in electronics, okay, then we try to contact the national organization saying, okay, this guy lives in that area and he's interested in this. What club is best for him? That's usually how we do that. Now, of course, we're here at Fosdem, so we have the contacts. The other option is you go to your local hackerspace or something. Usually there are a couple of hams over there and you talk to them and try to get some information on how the local scene is in your neighborhood, because that's where you live. And that's usually how things work. You get into radio, people operating, people electronics. So a lot of that's a very different, it's a very wide hobby, and that's also what explains a bit difficulty for us to explain or to get people and say, okay, that's where you need to go.
It's like, what do? You're into computers.
Okay, that's, yeah, that's great.
Nice and general.
That's so, what the outsider says. Oh, you're into computers, you know that. No, I don't do Windows. Don't ask about printers on the Windows. I don't know.
So for us, if you're in the Fosdem physical region, where are you sending people to?
Depending on their country, you send them to the local hubs.
What we do now is we have a contact list. We ask the location and their the country.
Yeah.
And if they are in Belgium, we have mandated by the national UBA, which is the national organization of the AMS, yeah, amateur radios, we contact the local club in that area. If it's from outside Belgium, or he or she, who knows, then we contact the national organization in his or her country and ask them to contact them. So that's the way we work.
Very good. Excellent stuff. Anything else I missed?
No, well, we have a lot of gear here to try to show up.
So what are you doing here? What are you trying to do today?
For me personally, I'm actually into electronics, so for my more electronic stuff, I have a couple of things. This is like a Wi-Fi dongle, which I've modified to work on 2.3 gigahertz instead of 2.4. Turns out this chip, this is a radio dongle, Wi-Fi dongle you can buy in China for, well, the well-known web shops for €8 or something.
Yeah.
And sold as a normal Wi-Fi dongle. But it turns out the chip in there can actually do from 2.3 to up to 2.7. Which is kind of interesting, so okay, let's give it a try. So I modified the Linux kernel, I put it in a Raspberry Pi, I modified the Linux kernel.
Let me have a look.
Yeah.
I can't see a thing.
This is... Okay, whoops, video for some reason.
Never mind. So this thing I have, the interesting thing was actually by doing that, I needed to modify the Linux kernel, which was the first time I did kernel modding. But actually by doing that, it turns out that the Wi-Fi protocol actually has certain links between frequency and channel IDs. So we actually need to modify the protocol, which is kind of fun. By doing that, you actually learn how Wi-Fi works, which is... Well, it was interesting for myself. Wi-Fi is something I use, and I do, like, I set up a mesh network, you configure commands, but you have no idea what actually is behind that. And this is kind of explains, by doing that, you get to learn things. What else do we have? Wi-Fi equivalent 433 equipment.
Sorry, what's that?
This is...
I see a Raspberry Pi connected up to
an Arduino. LoRa transmitter.
Yeah.
This one is a Raspberry Pi, sorry. This is the LoRa transmitter here.
Okay. Directly up to, what's a LoRa transmitter?
So LoRa is the protocol used for the Internet of Things.
Yeah.
The LoRa, they have low power, long distance modes, where you have in Amsterdam, the thing network. So we have people who work on three, these things are designed to work on 433 megahertz or the 787s, or what is the three frequencies. But it turns out this thing actually can work on any frequency. And because 433 is part of an amateur radio frequency, we are allowed to use them. Also with more power, because this thing actually is illegal in Belgium. It does 100 milliwatt, and you're not supposed to do 100 milliwatt in the 433 ISM band. But
it's not turned on, obviously.
Well, but for me as an amateur, this is part of an amateur radio band, and I'm allowed to use 150 watts.
Okay.
So the 100 milliwatt is not an issue. Okay, yeah. So it gives me more possibilities. This was a nice example of how you having a license actually gives you more possibilities to do certain special things.
Stand back, I'm a ham.
Okay.
So we got an antenna.
This is a Wi-Fi antenna, same thing. You're not allowed to do long distance Wi-Fi. You're limited to 100 milliwatt officially. 2.4 gig is an amateur band, so I'm allowed to use high power antennas and 1 watt Wi-Fi modules and so on.
So if you wanted, you're on a ranch somewhere and you wanted to send Wi-Fi down to your...
Yeah, you could run Wi-Fi up to a couple of kilometers with two of those high gain antennas talking. Well, if they see each other directly, yes.
But you'll need to broadcast your handle on that.
Yeah, well, what actually they do is you have call sign.
Yeah.
This is the name of your station. And the rule for Wi-Fi is that you need to configure your MAC address of your Wi-Fi with your call sign. Your call sign and ASCII. So you put your call sign and ASCII in your MAC address, and that's good enough.
Okay.
The regulator accepts that.
Excellent.
So,
actually awesome.
Yeah, well, you have to run. Amateur radio has a couple of, two main rules you have to apply to. One of them is no encryption, which is by itself not a bad thing. Because if you would have encryption, what means that you have commercial people on your frequencies.
Yeah.
Amateur radio is something where it allows the citizens or the individuals to communicate, to experiment with radio. And we are allowed to use specific frequencies for that. Yeah. But these frequencies actually are worth a lot of money, so the commercial companies do want to try to use them. So if you would allow encryption, with a lot of encrypted stuff somewhere, you don't know what it is, and you actually have our frequency being taken up by companies, so they don't have to pay a license for them, which is, this frequency is attributed to us as citizens, not to company. That's good. So no encryption. Second thing is that you need to be identifiable. So if there is some broadcast, they need to be able to
track down who it is.
Who it is. So either if you do something in the clear, an FM transmission, you can hear you. I just have to mention your name or your call sign a couple of times. If you do like digital stuff where it's more difficult to actually look at the content, then there are ways you could do that. Like in this case, you send your call sign and your MAC address. Or if you're experimenting, you actually send out digital data and you send your call sign in Morse code. And well, you just do a transmission, and after your transmission, you send you just your call sign. And that's one of the ways we actually still are in the rules, because they are able to identify you, but allow you to experiment with stuff that is not, well, if you, this one of, well, give an example. One of the things I did is use a digital voice protocol and digital voice modem. So the way you, there are two elements, is how you encode your voice into bitstream and how you send that bitstream over the radio. And I'm trying to mix those two, because there's an Australian ham who designed his own open source voice codec. So I want to try this. So when I'm transmitting that, nobody else can decode that, because it's experimental stuff. So nobody, if they would hear that transmission, would be know who it is. So that's to apply to the rule, to the identification. I add my old consign in Morse code just after my transmission, so they are able to track me if needed.
Very good.
So, amateur radio has certain rules. You have to live in a certain framework, but it does allow you to do a lot of things.
Okay, cool. Anything else going on here?
We have an HF station, so a shortwave station, do digital keyboard-to-keyboard communication. Okay. There's a big, giant antenna, by the way, if you look, if you come in...
Oh, I see the cable running around there.
So you have a giant mast, which is in front of the AW building.
Yeah.
So we use that to communicate with, pretty much Europe now, as a way to communicate, to show people what it is. It has a waterfall and so on, so it's quite visual, which is...
What's a waterfall?
It's something where you can see your signals, where you can actually see your signals in time, so you can see what is. So this is the waterfall.
So what I'm looking at is a scrolling screen of colors, waterfalling down.
Yeah, so this is a FLDigi, open source application for digital keyboard communication. So what it does actually is you type something, or your macro type something. It changes what you type into tones, frequencies, and these are sent over the radio. And depending on the radio paths you have, could be if you do shortwave communication, short paths, this will work. And if you have an environment with a lot of noise, someone else, some other way of encoding your data will work better. So it kind of, it's one of the experimenting areas of amateur radio. If you send data over a means, usually in this case it's a shortwave, it could be under a lot of different conditions. Could be that it's nice, that everything works okay. Could be a lot of noise. Could be there's a lot of static. Could be lightning in the area, so they have a lot of static going on. Could be that your signal is reflected twice or three times, so signals kind of mixed together. So depending on the environment, there are different ways to encode your text into tones, which then get decoded back from tones to text. So this is one of the areas, and this is one of the applications used for that. FLDigi is completely open source. It's Windows, Mac, Linux. And what it does, it's what you type actually send over the radio, and you see those waterfalls, which are the,
incoming signals.
Yes, if you look at the web SDR, the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's what we have. So this is one of the things that we're showing off to people, what it is. And
I'll try and put a link to the web one that people can try this at home.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. I think everybody should do it. And on HPR, we're running a ham radio series tutorial thing with all our hams coming together.
I didn't know that.
So tune in for that. Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm talking to
Leonardo.
Hi, can you tell me what Cortex Lab is?
Sure. Cortex Lab is actually a room where we have many software-defined radio cards, and it can be used actually for testing out new communication techniques, for 5G or for IoT. All these kinds of things can be tested inside of this room. The particularity of this room is actually that it's shielded from the outside, so we have no interference coming in or going out of the room. And this allows us actually to do tests in any frequency band that we want. We can do frequency, I mean, testing in any frequency without being afraid of, you know, interfering with a, you know, a public radio or something like that. And its main objective actually is to allow research on radio, on cognitive radio, software defined radio, and all these things.
But surely that's illegal if you go outside of the bands.
Yeah, of course it's illegal. But it, since we're inside of the room and everything is contained, we are sure that we're not creating any interference with any public, you know, police or fire, you know, fireman. Yeah, all these things.
So where is this lab based?
So we're based in Lyon. We're the university there. Actually, we're called Inside de Lyon, and this is actually based in our lab. So we have the underground of the lab. There is a place where the room is hosted.
Okay. So why are you even here? Who cares about your room?
Yeah. So we're trying to spread out the word about this room. It's we have inaugurated it in 2014, and we're trying to attract the attention of the GNU Radio community in general. But also of researchers, industrials, anyone who's interested in having a facility like that to try out their new algorithms and communication standards.
But that's going to be expensive, surely.
Yes. No. I mean, to access the room is for free.
For free, but that is expensive. If you have to pay for that, that is very expensive.
Yes. So we actually a publicly funded project from France. So we have the money, which was given to us by the French, how do I say that? The French government, let's say like this. And the idea is that we create this room and we offer it for free to anyone in the world who wants to use it. So this is one of the main objectives of this project.
So I'm a ham radio enthusiast, example, and I have a brilliant idea for a highly efficient network. What do I need to do? How do I get in touch?
Okay, so actually you go to our website, which is http://www.
There'll be links in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, okay, so that's great. So so actually you go to our website, there's a wiki, there's a place in the wiki that explains exactly how to ask for an account. So you get the account, and then you come to our website again, and there's lots of tutorials which are explaining how to get started with Cortex Lab, and actually with GNU Radio as well. So it's a two-on-one. You mean you learn how to use GNU Radio and Cortex Lab all at once.
So GNU, what is GNU Radio real quick?
So GNU Radio is a toolbox, a sort of a toolbox that allows us to create any kind of communication scheme easily. It has a very nice graphical interface where you can attach blocks together. And you can create, for example, a very simple transmission scheme. You can decode FM. You can, you know, hack satellite communications, lots of these things. And people are using it a lot, and it's actually very, very popular right now.
Yeah, there's probably a whole go of talks on the FOSDEM website about that. I know there were last year. And but I'll need to come to France, obviously, to set all this stuff up.
No, of course not. So you can access the testbed through the internet. So it's just a simple SSH access. You have some websites where you can follow what's going on your experiment. So it's actually all web-based, all internet-based.
Okay, absolutely awesome. I don't know what more to say, really. So what, Annie, how long has this been going? Do you have any plans for developing it? What if you get too many people coming along?
So actually we've been ongoing since 2014. So this is when we actually inaugurated the room. The project has been going from 2012, and we are funded until 2020 or 21. I don't remember very well. And we plan to extend that to the future. And the idea is that actually we get as many users as we can. Yes. So we have a scheduling system where you can book the platform for a certain amount of time, and you can do whatever you want in it. And if you have your own or your own communication schemes that you want to try out, the only thing that you need to do is you need to convert that whatever you have it in into GNU Radio. Or actually, if you have a Linux executable, you can do that as well. It needs to communicate to the UHD driver, which is a driver for these EDOS USRPs. And then you can just bring the code and run it on our platform. It's very simple, very, very straightforward.
And there's no cost involved in it?
No cost at all, for free.
No cost involved in getting a state-of-the-art room to try out whatever you want.
That's it. Everything's for free.
Oh, you gotta love that. Excellent. Thank you very much. Have we missed anything?
No, I think it's I think we covered everything more or less.
Okay, so if you're into radio and you want to try this stuff out, go to cortexlab.fr. Thank you very much. I'm at the Open Embedded booth, and you're I'm talking to
Andreas Müller.
And can you tell me what Open Embedded is, what you're doing here, what am I looking at?
Okay, it's a Open Embedded, it's a build system for embedded devices. You can build for a device of your choice, images containing package management and
So what have I got here?
We have here a Raspberry Pi 2 running a desktop XFCE. Or other desktop of your choice. We are on the right side. We have a BeagleBone Black running the same image. And the demo, for instance, is here a sequencer with a MIDI keyboard, and you can.
All running on Open Embedded.
Yes. Yes.
So instead of Raspberry Pi running Raspbian, you're running Open Embedded.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And what's the advantage of that?
Pardon?
What is Open Embedded itself?
Open Embedded is a collection of recipes to build a complete image for an embedded device, beginning with the bootloader, kernel, and user space stuff, everything which is available in open source world. You can build whatever you want.
Why would I want that?
Because you run the same images, or the code base is the same for different devices. As you can see here, we have the Raspberry Pi and the BeagleBone, and the code base of this is exactly the same. To build an image for the Raspberry Pi or for the BeagleBone is just a matter of setting a configuration.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where do I get Open Embedded?
You get Open Embedded at the Open Embedded websites. Open Embedded consists of several layers. There are different board support package layers. There is, for instance, a layer for a Qt stuff. And one address where you can get also first information is on the Yocto project. There are very good documentations available there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are you demoing today? You've got the sequencer and you've got...
Yeah, we can do whatever, what a Linux desktop is capable of. We have, starting from... okay, we have some... okay, the game stuff, we have graphic stuff here, GIMP, whatever you want, the LibreOffice stuff, multimedia stuff. It is just
So why do we need another Linux distro? Why can't I just use Debian?
Because you cannot use Debian on the BeagleBone. It's just...
Whatever you can use Open Embedded on multiple hardware devices.
Yes,
okay,
this is
now,
yes.
Yeah.
It's my first time.
No. So what has been happening in the Open Embedded community in the last year?
To be honest, I don't really know that. I need to see just a matter of growing. It's my personal perspective. All this multimedia stuff has happened, this is my
focus as a developer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. I'm going to walk down to see what other Open Embedded projects there are.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.